What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Who are you supposed to be?
I'm Josh Larson.
That doesn't sound like a superhero to me.
I ain't no superhero, lady. I'm just a kid from the neighborhood, all right?
We should have taken a cue from Harvey Pekar there in that scene from American Splendor. Instead, our top five this Halloween movie costumes that we'd wear.
Spoiler, I'm going to go with Kid from the Neighborhood as my number one.
You never were that creative. We even invited our friend Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune to join us for our in-studio costume party, plus a review of Birdman starring Michael Keaton. That and more.
I'm Birdman.
Ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals.
To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. That's audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. We're also supported by Film Spotting listeners, including new gold-level donor Tim McNerney in Oakland, California, and Connor in Teddington, Middlesex, UK. Josh, Teddington, Middlesex, do you know where that's at? Any idea?
It's somewhere in the UK.
It is. In fact, it's basically London, my Google search is correct. But Teddington, Middlesex is just a lot more fun to say.
That's true.
Thank you very much, Connor, Tim, and to all of our Film Spotting donors. You're listening to Film Spotting. The Chicago Tribune's Michael Phillips joins us this week. Michael, it's been a little while. Welcome back.
Yeah, it has been.
Great to have you here. Now, most of our listeners don't know this, but you're a little bit of a diva. Every time you come on these monthly appearances, you make certain stipulations. Usually it's things behind the scenes, like certain M&Ms and certain drinks and types of finger sandwiches you need in the green room.
Yes.
For this special Halloween episode, it was that we had to dress up like the Marx Brothers. So you're Groucho, of course. You look wonderful. I called Chico. That left Josh with Harpo.
Oh.
Josh, can we hear your Harpo? So for the remainder of the episode, when you hear the horn, you'll know that's Josh. I love this. I don't know why we didn't think of this sooner.
I will also
just the horn for you.
Be pulling a gookie face every time that horn blows.
If only we were a video show as well. Later in the show, we will share our top five movie costumes that we would wear.
But first, our review of Birdman, an ambitious comedy drama that takes jabs at costume superheroes, egotistical actors, and elitist critics. Time to find out how well the three of us can take a punch.
We had it all. You were a movie star, remember?
Who was this guy?
He used to be Birdman.
I like that poster.
You wrote this adaptation?
I did, yeah.
And you're directing and starring in your adaptation. That's ambitious.
Are you afraid people will say you're doing this play to battle the impression that you're a washed-up comic strip character?
Absolutely not. That's why 20 years ago I said no to Birdman 4.
Hold the mask off!
Thank you, everybody.
You do hold the mask off!
Now you're about to destroy what's left of your career. You know I'm right.
You're so nice!
Alejandro G. Iñárritu would probably bristle at such simple labeling, but through five films, I think we can safely call him a filmmaker who enjoys his high concepts. Which is to say, you can quickly describe his movies to someone employing the same shorthand used to title Friends episodes. 2000's Amores Perros, a.k.a. the one with three stories connected by a car accident. 2003's 21 Grams, a.k.a. the nonlinear one that also features three stories connected by a car accident. 2006's Babel, a.k.a. the other nonlinear one about characters who are connected, but not by a car accident. 2010's Beautiful, a.k.a. the one where Javier Bardem and pretty much everyone else around him suffers for 150 minutes. Okay, so maybe that one doesn't fit so nicely. Beautiful doesn't involve any structural hijinks or unifying tragic events, just a whole lot of good old-fashioned chronological misery, which in and of itself becomes a sort of high concept. Well, and Iñárritu has dusted off his bag of tricks. Besides the obvious meta-ness of Michael Keaton, the original movie Batman, playing Regan Thompson, an action star famous for donning and then refusing to redon a cowl 20-plus years ago, there's also Iñárritu's formal approach to Birdman, a.k.a. the one that's made to look like one long take. Although there are clear temporal transitions, and it's usually apparent where the cuts are hidden, the action appears to unfold continuously, a la Rope or Russian Ark. Michael, there's no denying the technical artistry on display, the precision with which the great Emmanuel Lubezki's camera winds through the corridors of Broadway's St. James Theater, stalking, encircling, capturing Inarritu and Keaton's formidable ensemble of actors, including Edward Norton and Naomi Watts. Such precision and tight choreography in cinema can be potent, seductive. Does it help Birdman soar, or is this just more arty, high-concept anguish in Inarritu style?
Well, the anguish weighs less in Birdman. That's the main thing. And I think that's why a lot of audiences, different types of moviegoers are responding to it, even if they weren't eager to revisit another movie like that had that sort of 40-ton solemnity of Babel and Beautiful. And I mean, I think Beautiful's still actually going. It hasn't ended yet. I mean, I remember starting at a can,
yeah,
and it's not over yet. I think all that wizardry helps because it really is it's more than just technical assurance. It's really, you know, it's a series of decisions that I think help the swirl of things work. And whether you responded to this material or not, this is a story of a lot of things that are happening kind of to and around this beleaguered, somewhat faded movie star played by Keaton. And it's, you know, all that sort of snake-like, you know, all these prowling tracking shots, it really is kind of marvelous to see an essentially, I mean, not that the making of a play, a Broadway play, or anything to do with the theater on screen is necessarily static, but this is certainly the most kinetic look you've ever seen at a backstage drama, especially. And it's fun to watch. I mean, that's, to me, I wish I had something more sophisticated to say just sort of as a general response, guys. But, I mean, to me, Birdman is fun to watch. Now, does that visual delight make up for the banality of a lot of the ideas in it? I'd say yes.
That's the question.
On balance, it does, but only that. And it's a film I wouldn't mind seeing a second time, but it's not because of anything anyone is actually saying out loud in the movie.
Josh?
Yeah, the camera work for me, it was exhausting the first 15 minutes, and that was right on. I thought that worked beautifully in a couple of ways. It put us in the Keaton character's head in a sense, and also captured this hysteria that he was under, that this is a huge project he's taken on. It's falling apart just days before opening night. They're in previews. And it also gave us an idea of the panic of what might go into putting on a show. It really roots us in that sensibility. So to me, it was a perfect match thematically for the character. And the other thing I thought it did well is this theater that the entire movie takes place in, we get to know
although not the entire. I mean, it was three quarters of it.
Yeah, I guess so.
You're
there's the hospital at the end. You go out
on the street. He goes to the store.
The majority. You get to know every nook and cranny.
Yeah.
And that helps. It helped me at least to feel that creative claustrophobia that the movie was trying to bring about, so that I knew also when a character turned eventually, it was a little bit like The Shining. You started to get a feel of what was around every corner. And all that did for me was emphasize this sense of they can't escape this play. And I think Riggan references how it's following him around and chasing him like a little version of himself. He says something like that. And we get that sense because we can't escape it either, because this camera seemingly never rests. And it is, for the most part, chasing up and down the same halls. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Michael, you used the phrase, it's kind of marvelous. And I'd say, yeah, it is kind of marvelous, but I wish I had the same reaction to it that it sounds like Josh had. I never was exhilarated by it at any point. And maybe I think the banality of a lot of the ideas, and we'll get into that, is maybe the key problem. But for whatever reason, yes, it's frenetic by its very nature. You have that camera. It's incessant. It's rotating. It's in motion all the time.
I wouldn't call it frenetic. I would argue with that.
Just the fact that it's always in motion, there's a certain type of kinetic pace to that,
right.
I think you have to allow for. But, of course, it is also so clearly broken up into segments. It's never intended to be real time. You do see these transitions of hours that sometimes go by.
Yeah, and you're spanning several days.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it never really provoked any kind of visceral reaction in me. There wasn't that relentless drive. There wasn't that claustrophobia to it, really, at any point. It's funny because we referenced in teasing this last week on the show, Scott Tobias over at the Dissolve, his takedown of this movie, really hated it. And he even allows for one thing in Yard 2 gets right. He says the gimmick, in terms of the camera work, succeeds in carrying tension throughout the entire two-hour ordeal, trapping viewers in a pressure cooker atmosphere as Riggan and his players struggle to keep it together. I don't know that it really succeeded. It was kind of fun to watch just as artistry. I don't know that it really added anything. The most exciting moments for me, honestly, were watching the quiet conversations. I enjoyed watching when that camera settled down and we actually got to watch Edward Norton and Emma Stone on that rooftop talk to each other. That was the most successful aspect of this film for me. And I think part of it, too, I'll just say, is the ending of this film, or the maybe 12 to 15 different endings I felt like it had. Mm. At one point, it feels like he knows that he wants to end it on a note of uplift, or it's going to be fantasy, or it's going to be bleak, or it's going to be something metaphysical and unexplainable. It never landed on one that ever
I would say metaphysical and unexplainable is where it landed for me, for sure. Hmm. And I would never use the word gimmick for a move that is this effective and this, again, thematically involved in what the movie is trying to do. I mean, I think of a gimmick as a little trick that's there to maybe distract you from other things going on.
Well, hold on. So what is the movie trying to do?
I think it's trying to put us in Riggan's head, essentially. It does this through the voiceover when we hear the Birdman character. Mm. It does this through those scenes where we see him have some sort of telekinetic powers, and we're asking ourselves, do these exist? Are they his imagination? We're always in this in-between space that may be his delirium, it may be his mental illness, it mm-hmm. may be just his egomania, or maybe it's really what's happening. And I like that the movie never answered that. And the one way we can get that sense that I felt was by having this camera never leave either. If the camera breaks up, then we're getting these demarcations between reality and fantasy. By never really leaving, in a sense, we know that it is. But by the guise that it's not leaving, we're in this netherworld mm-hmm. that, again, was exhausting in a way that I felt made for a unique movie-going experience.
I agree that it's trying to cast that spell. And I think, for the most part, it probably does pull that off. I wish that it really caught me up in a way that made me feel that sort of exhaustion that you're describing. I didn't.
You can describe a lot of what happens in Birdman as, you know, frantic and frenetic, and, you know, it's certainly kind of an anxiety-driven mm-hmm. storyline with this guy facing all kinds of crises and deadlines, and, you know, he's trying to repair the broken relationship with his grown daughter, the Emma Stone character. He's trying to make peace with his ex-wife, played by Amy Ryan. He's got, he's got relationship issues in the present tense with one of the actresses. It's all that sort of suggests a certain amount of chaos, and that's there. But really, what that camera work, what the style of those long takes imparts is a much more elegant kind of feeling. And that mm-hmm. I think that's what does make it seem a little different and a little fresh, just because it's a little more, it's closer to, say, what Scorsese's up to in The Goodfellas, you know, the famous, you know, the Coppa entrance mm-hmm. shot. It's everything I say against Birdman, I have to throw in the caveats that I think it's worth seeing.
Well, let's do too.
But I would say this, and this is the kind of the talking point about long takes. When you look at a less organic example of a really long take that's impressive in one way and kind of pointless in another, like the long Dunkirk
beach
against
you're
an atonement.
So wrong.
There's nothing.
You're so wrong.
No,
how could
no.
you go to that one of all the ones to go to?
Well, that's my go-to for a movie that I actually like in
atonement?
A lot of ways, but I just think
Joe Wright's guilty of another films, including Hannah. I don't think Dunkirk's it, but
I'm with you. But
agree to disagree.
I don't know about that one. I just think it's pretty, but I think that's the wrong moment to be pretty. And I think Birdman, it's basically, I take it as kind of just a juicy, somewhat cliched backstage comedy with sort of misguided notions about how easy or how hard to be on its protagonist. But maybe we'll talk about that mm-hmm. in a second.
Well, let's also say that this long take is not standing alone there on an island saying, look at me, what I'm doing here. It's working in conjunction with other elements in the film. And the soundtrack is one of them. This
I like that.
Percussive score yeah,
really.
That we
I
get.
I like it a lot. It
drove me crazy.
Is, really?
But it's supposed to. That's what
–
it's just another element that's keeping you on edge.
It's another too cute element.
How is it too cute when it's used – what is cute about it when
what's
it's
cute
used
is like when he then cuts to it and we see that there's actually a drummer on
oh,
the
I love
screen.
That that's, shot. I love that shot. And then the drummer shows up.
Too clever by
then
half.
The drummer shows up later in the break room of the stage in like a 2-second shot. And that's just such a nice touch because, again, we don't know where we are when that happens. Who's seeing that? Are we seeing it? Is Riggan seeing
it?
Is the drumming
to himself,
in his head?
That's all it is.
Well, the movies need to draw some attention to themselves, to what they're doing. And I don't see that any of these things stand out apart from what else is going on in the film. They're all of a piece. The camera work, the soundtrack, and the thing that a lot of the discussion about this film is forgetting, which is the main thing for me about it, is Keaton's performance, because he is doing something that is also hurtling, a high wire act. It's not just a high wire act. It's like a guy on a high wire that things are being pelted at him as well. And you don't know sometimes if he's going to make it through some of these scenes. He seems literally out of breath, both as the character and the performer. I think he's stretching a little bit here as an actor beyond his capabilities. But you know what? So is the character. And there was something fascinating about watching that duality play out here. Again, it's tied in with the soundtrack. It's tied in with the camera work. This is maybe not one of the best performances that we would consider of the year or something like that. But man, is it exhilarating, again, to watch him walk that tightrope.
Yes. In the interview, your father was a drunk like Carver. Is that true, Matt? Is that true?
No.
Because my father was. My father was a mean drunk. You understand?
Okay.
He beat the out of us. It was okay, though, you know, because at least he was beating us. He wasn't thinking about taking us out to his tool shed. Because we're looking at the tool shed, that son of a bitch would smile. I could say, you want to get down here? He's unbuckle my belt. Or do you want me to take it off and use it on you? After a while, I made myself numb, so, you know. But my little sister.
Okay, okay, okay. Hey, 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 hey. Hey. Oh, God. I didn't know. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. That's horrible, man. I'm sorry.
It's also not true. See, I can pretend to.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam, Josh, and Michael Phillips. We're discussing the new film Birdman, starring Michael Keaton. And I like Keaton's performance. He's an actor I've obviously praised a lot here on the show, and it is nice to see him really get a juicy performance. And the way you described it's accurate. Unfortunately, I do feel like he's so relentless in that performance and so out of breath and so hurtling towards the next moment that moments that actually really required the sort of stillness and gravitas of an actor that really could have brought some truth to those moments, that instead he's so busy going past.
Maybe another actor might have, but that's the whole point, is the breathlessness.
I will say this, though. I think I'm surprised, because I think we have similar reservations, Adam, about the film, although I might like it a tick more than you, but I don't know how many people would experience things like Keaton's performance and the percussive musical score in the same way you did, because you're saying that they were just exhausting and kind of overwhelming.
Yeah.
I think if you really listen to that drum-based score, that it's actually pretty sparingly used. It's just that it's unusual instrumentation in that it's essentially a drum kit and usually just one drum, adding fills here and there. I don't know. I just didn't look. Inarritu can be the most suffocating guy on the planet with the camera, and some people, you know, my issues with the I hate to be a screenplay schmuck on this subject, because I know it's all about the direction of this medium, but I think the limitations of Birdman are all about what you are or are not getting from this script. I think even in its moments of broad farce and sort of stylish visual comedy, it's not a particularly funny film, even when it's trying. And I think I guess I've seen a lot of films lately that had the nerve to be really quite hard on its protagonists if they happen to be kind of driven, blinkered, selfish artists. Like, you look at a movie like Listen Up, Philip, which I love, and I mean that film's got balls of steel, I think. But it's this film, Birdman, by contrast, is very nervous about discomforting the audience at all about Keaton's character. He's really a nice guy. The worst he could say is he didn't spend much time with his daughter, and even that's sort of thrown off in the script. Is like, really, that's the worst thing somebody says to the Emma
Edward
Stone
Norton
character?
Does, yeah.
yeah, this is the worst thing you can say about him. So I mean, it's a very unchallenging stance toward that protagonist in the end. I think that's what limits the achievement of the picture.
I agree with you. I think unchallenging is really the key word. And I think, Josh, if it really was just about Keaton and sort of that character's unhingedness, I think I probably would have responded to the movie a lot better than I did. But I do think it's...
He's hinged.
I do think
he's
trying
He's
to
not
say,
unhinged. He's hinged.
I think it's trying to say, important things. I think the movie thinks it's making insightful comments about media, about culture, about criticism, and it's just so weak here in this movie. We could talk about the silly notions of Twitter followers equaling power, the idiocy of the New York Times critic in the movie, and her hostility and unprofessionalism, the unimaginative takes in general on art versus entertainment we could discuss for 10 or 15 more minutes. But for me, actually, what really didn't work, it's the thing that I normally love when filmmakers do, and we disagree about it often here on the show, and that's when they indict the audience, when they indict me as a viewer, and they try to make me think about my relationship to these topics, to celebrity, to movies, to culture. Some recent examples, Fincher does it in Gone Girl, we talked about that. Tarantino in Inglourious Basterds, Michael Haneke in Funny Games, Cachet and others. Scorsese does it at the end of The Wolf of Wall Street, and we differed on that as well. Some people and some critics, they find those examples, many of them, not all the same, but some of them condescending or patronizing. I think it's condescending or patronizing when it has no bite to it, when there's no teeth to the commentary whatsoever. And that's the problem here. It comes up multiple times. His agent, Keaton's agent, is played by Zach Galifianakis, and he is he's always talking about that, sort of what the audience wants and what we should give them. It culminates in this fantasy sequence where Birdman addresses the audience directly, right? He looks to us in the crowd and says, you know, after a bunch of explosions and this action movie fight sequence, we all see it in the trailer. He says, look at them. They love this. They're eating it up. And you know what? I might have eaten it up, but I really felt like the movie was just using it as just a flashy, cynical joke in that moment. There's never at any point in this film any moment of recognition on my part where I thought, yeah, you know what? I am kind of eating this up. That is what I want. I'm part of this problem. I thought it was just flimsy meta-ness for the sake of meta-ness because it's cool. And the drummer, unfortunately, fit into that to me. There's no substance to any of the meta-ness here in this film.
Are there Inarritu films you like better than this?
The only one I like is Amores Perros, which I haven't seen since I saw it originally, but I loved it when I saw it originally.
Right.
Yeah, well, and I'm not real high on his stuff either. I do like Amores Perros, probably the best of his.
I would put
this after it. I think when you look at his filmography, what's interesting is this is fairly light for what he's done.
Oh, it's the lightest one.
I think, you know, that there's something encouraging about that. I think there's, boy, I didn't really pick up on any sort of indictment of the audience. Those instances that you mentioned are there, but they're also in a melange of other instances of, you know, actors being egotistical and taking the creative process too seriously. I mean, there's some self-parody going on here as well. Now, I will agree with both of you that I didn't come away from this movie with any real new discoveries about the creative process, about making art and its costs and some of the things that they talk about. They do a lot of talking here. But I would call the movie obvious. And when it has other things going on to keep my attention and to really enthral me, like Keaton's performance, like the visuals and the soundtrack, I'm okay with the movie being obvious. I mean, that's all right. So it's not the deepest thing in the world. That's not always a crime.
I think a lot of the ideas you're hearing in this movie about what you're talking about, Josh, about just sort of, you know, about art versus entertainment, as Adam said, and they're just, you know, two of these screenwriters come from Argentina, and what this is an arcane reference, but I've seen an awful lot of theater that was basically absurdist black comedy from various Latin American countries where you kind of get these issues dealt with on the table. But now it feels kind of stale and secondhand, and I just think the movie doesn't seem ambiguous in a good way about whether or not Reagan's a completely misguided blowhard, or is he really a serious artist trying to get out, or what? It just seems indecisive and wobbly to me. You know, you don't really know if the, and again, I don't need everything answered for me, but it's not the satiric edge. To me, isn't really there because there's just something kind of fundamentally humorless about Inarritu as an artist. And I don't, you know, that, you know, people said the same thing about Kubrick and Dr. Strangelove, but that wasn't true.
I think the cast helps a lot with that, though, because I did find Keaton to be funny here. I thought Edward Norton is quite funny as well.
Where the direction may fail
in playing up the comedy, I think the cast helps with that a lot. And I don't know if we're supposed to come away with a judgment on the Keaton character. I mean, I think it's just presenting a guy in this situation who stands in for what a number of Hollywood actors might be facing nowadays with the way the industry has turned towards superhero pictures. And that's interesting enough. I mean, I think they do give some layers to him. It's not just that he has this daughter who's, he has a broken relationship with. There's a long moment, one of those quiet conversations, Adam, is with him and Amy Ryan, where they talk about this horrible betrayal of her that she did, and she doesn't want to bring it up, and he spends time. So, you know, the guy is nasty and kind of a jerk, and I got a good sense of that. I didn't feel like Keaton was playing for the audience's sympathy at all.
Let me say this. I think the script is doing everything it can to vindicate Reagan's choices in life, to let him off the hook, to really keep reminding you that at heart he's a sweetie pie played by Michael Keaton, everybody's favorite actor. I don't know.
Is Michael Keaton everybody's favorite actor?
I guess
I mean, he's kind of a guy who keeps you a little uneasy.
Well, it's drawing on that persona.
You know? I mean,
yeah. Well, maybe. Yeah, maybe so. I don't know. I guess I just feel like I've seen when the movie calms down, deliberately calms down and sort of rests visually and focuses more on, okay, here's a two-person scene between Keaton and Emma Stone, Keaton and Amy Ryan. That's when you start noticing what some of us feel is kind of the more routine, conventional writing here, where it's just the same sort of surreally patient ex-wife, you know, understanding ex-wife you've seen in five 5,000 other movies. I don't know. The types seem more. That's where you really notice the clunkiness of some of the archetypes here, especially with things like, and these are played by some of the best actors. We have Lindsay Duncan playing this, you know, this vicious, vitriolic New York Times critic who informs Keaton. You know, she's the only New York Times critic ever to actually write a review in a theater bar, you know, where she just can't wait to tell me, you know, I haven't seen your play yet, but I'm gonna destroy it because you're Hollywood, not Broadway. I don't know. That doesn't make a good satiric point. That doesn't make a good serious point. That's where I start questioning who cares about realism? You know, this is no documentary, but this is where I start questioning whether or not it just feels like it's all coming from old movies and plays.
Exactly. Yeah.
Visually, it doesn't feel that way. It does feel you shouldn't be able to separate this element out, but it feels freshly imagined, and that's what I don't get from every dialogue scene.
I think, Michael, you put it really well in saying that there's a difference between indecisiveness and ambiguity, and I felt as if I was getting indecisiveness from this film. And Josh, it sounds like you really dove into some of the meatiness of more ambiguity. I wish I had felt that as well with this movie. But the key there, when you talk about some of the broadness to the characters and the archetypes here, you need a really good actor, and there are many of them in this movie, but you need a really good actor like Ed Norton who can rise above those archetypes and deliver some of those clunky lines in a way that not only do they not sound clunky, like you actually believe it and you completely buy it. And he has the best line in the movie, the absolute best line in the movie, which should be the worst line in the movie, when he's talking to Emma Stone, who's Keaton's daughter, and she's been through rehab, and she's kind of playing this little sexual game with him. They're playing truth or dare, and she says to him, "If you could do anything, you know, what would you do to me right now if you weren't afraid?" And she's suggesting something sexual. And his line is so great. "I would want to pull the eyes out of your head and stick them in my skull and then look out at this street and see it the way I saw it when I was your age." I mean, and in that moment, like, you think about that line, how, yes, clunky that has to be, how pretentious it sounds, the way he's talking about Broadway and how this is what he really wants more than anything, any kind of sexual relationship with her. And yet Norton in that moment just delivers it with a kind of real melancholy,
he gets all the fun in every scene in this film. Yeah, I mean, I think that's the one thing that seems to unite the people who are, you know, really like the movie a lot, like it a little bit or like it in the middle somewhere, don't like it at all. I think Norton, the scene where he and Keaton are having this really sort of pathetic brawl as conducted by people who don't know how to brawl in the dressing room. That's a great example of what actors with really good comic instincts can do to a very simple premise that, again, we've seen it before, but it's just that comes close to the sense of humor that maybe I lack in some of the other scenes.
And the Keaton-Norton dynamic is so great for this story, too, because you have Keaton as this has-been Hollywood actor who's trying to make a name for himself on the stage, or at least hold his own on the stage, and you have Norton as this stage hero.
The method actor gone wild.
So he's supposed to be a better actor than Keaton, and he out-acts Keaton
in
every scene.
That almost works.
And the way they play with that is just another one of these. I mean, you know, you generally go for the meta stuff more than I do, but here it was one of those little tweaks that was just such a joy to watch.
Yeah, no, that definitely does make sense in those scenes when they're acting on a stage and they're playing the actor within those scenes. When Michael Keaton's just being the character, Edward Norton's still out acting him.
So the scene where Keaton tricks him by putting on a mini performance. You didn't buy that.
My least favorite Keaton moment in the film. Didn't buy it for a second, and I don't believe that Edward Norton character would have bought it either. So, yeah, you nailed it. Birdman sounds like we're kind of all over the place a little bit on this one. It is out now in limited release if you see it. And agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
Massacre Theater is next. I can only assume we'll be doing a Marx Brothers routine. And this Harpo wig is really itchy, so can we just jump into the top five movie costumes we'd wear after that?
I suppose.
Matt, thanks. Stay with us.
What is moving will be still. What is gathered will disperse. What's been built up will collapse. All of your dreams, they're all fulfilled. New Year's Eve paper had on your head. It was hard to believe that you'd ever be dead. And that dream that you're falling, you had since you're five, is a bird on your shoulder that whispers goodbye, goodbye. What is moving will be still. What is gathered will disperse. What's been built up will collapse. All of your dreams, they're all fulfilled. Liza Minnelli spent a month in a bed. She was certain that sky that would fall on her head.
Hey folks, a quick reminder here that we're supported this week by Audible. Audible.com is a leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. They are a great way to listen when you are on your commute, you're working out, whatever you're doing when you're normally listening to Film Spotting, well, audiobooks are good for that as well. And they are offering you a free download to give you a chance to try out their service if they haven't already. We have a recommendation that comes to you via one of our longtime listeners and one of our great feedback writers, Josh. He is Chris Bentley Smith in Cambridge, UK, and he sent this to us back in March. But I did a little searching and I looked it over, and I don't think we've actually had a chance yet to share this recommendation. And even if we have, it's a good one. So we're going to do it here.
Chris says the book is a debut novel called We Used to Be Kings by Stuart Foster. It tells the story of Tom, who's on the verge of adulthood and about to leave the young person's institution he has been living in, and his younger brother, Jack. The only thing is, Jack has been dead for several years, and yet to Tom, he's very much alive. I've not heard the audio version myself, but I would be interested to hear how narrator Tom Lawrence differentiates between Tom and Jack, the voice in Tom's head, given the central role their inseparability plays in the narrative. Foster tells his story with such deep compassion for these two boys that you shouldn't be surprised to find yourself carrying them around with you days after finishing the book. I know I did.
Sounds like a fascinating book. Thank you for the recommendation, Chris. And we are always encouraging your recommendations. If you are an Audible user or you've just had a chance recently to check out an audiobook and you want to recommend it, if it's on Audible, we will throw that out to our audience. Just email us feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also tweet your rec to us or go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/filmspotting. If you want to try to download We Used to Be Kings or another book for free, just go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. That's audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
Who knows their own story? Certainly it makes no sense when we are living in the midst of it. It's all just clamor and confusion. It only becomes a story when we tell it and retell it. Our small, precious recollections that we speak again and again to ourselves or to others. First creating the narrative of our lives, and then keeping the story from dissolving into darkness.
Welcome back to Film Spotting, where you know I'm a sucker for films that talk about creating the narrative of our lives. That's Nick Cave in some voiceover from the new pseudo-documentary that at least claims to show a day in the life of the Australian singer, rocker, screenwriter. The movie is 20,000 Days on Earth, which I actually had a chance to catch up with. It's rare, Josh, you know, that I get a chance to see movies that aren't movies we're planning on reviewing on the show, but I had a night free, the rare night free, made it out to see this movie. I don't know, Michael, if you caught up with this film.
I've not seen 20,000.
I came into it with really no relationship to Nick Cave whatsoever. I'm familiar with him. I could probably pick him out of a lineup, but that's about it. Heard one or two of his songs. But really, because of what you heard there, that discussion of the narrative of our lives, I walked away from this really impressed and really sort of kind of wanting to learn more about him. But that's not even really the thrill of the movie. I think it's more just kind of how, as a documentary, it plays with truth a little bit. And I ended up thinking of it that at the end of the film, I could believe that everything I saw was 100% factual, exactly as it was presented, or it could have been all made up except for here's Nick Cave and he's a rock star from Australia. That might have been the only thing true, and everything else was this sort of Holy Motors-esque concoction. Either way, it doesn't matter. I don't even want to know the truth.
Do you want to know, or would that ruin the magic?
No, I haven't. I've refused to Google it because I just want to bask in the magic.
Now, how does it relate to your response to, say, the Joaquin Phoenix, I'm Not There?
A movie I hated.
Yeah.
I absolutely hated. I'd really have to think about that more to decide what the key differences are. But that movie, 20,000 Days on Earth, is out now in select theaters, including here in Chicago. And I did write about it a little bit on Letterboxd. If you're not following, at least Josh and I over there, we occasionally do write a few words about movies that we don't discuss on the show. Our current poll question over at filmspotting.net, we gave it to you last week, and we're going to challenge Michael with it here this week. Best screenwriter turned director debut. We have the front runner, certainly, we anticipated, but it is a good fight for second place. Your pencil wielding protagonists: David, House of Games Mamet, Shane, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang Black, Steven, Searching for Bobby Fischer's Alien, Charlie, Synecdoche, New York, Kaufman, and Tony, Michael Clayton, Gilroy. The tie-in, next week's review of Nightcrawler with Jake Gyllenhaal. That movie's screenwriter turned director is also a Gilroy, Tony Gilroy's brother, Dan. Charlie Kaufman, Synecdoche, New York, as we thought, Josh. Definitely.
That's in the lead.
Running away with it so far. But already some great listener comments in the poll. Not sure if you saw the one pointing out a major oversight. Henrik Hansen, longtime listener, took us to task for leaving off Lawrence Kasdan.
Oh, yeah.
His directing debut, guys?
Body Heat.
Body Heat.
Body Heat.
He was one of the writers
But more importantly.
Yeah, one of the writers on not only Raiders of the Lost Ark, which I think we're contractually obligated to bring up every time you sit down here in studio with us, Michael.
God. The religion.
The religion of Raiders. Yes. But he was also a writer on a little movie called The Empire Strikes Back.
Oh, yeah. So, my favorite of the Star Wars.
Well, I'm with you on that.
All right,
not sure how well Body Heat would have fared in this poll, but Henrik, consider ashamed. Please do add your vote and your comments over at filmspotting.net. And if you leave a comment, we'd love to know where you're writing from. With that, let's move on now to Massacre Theater. Last time, Josh, we massacred this scene.
In summation, I think you just got to not do it, man. That's all.
I understand what you're saying, and your comments are valuable, but I'm going to ignore your advice.
The cuss you are.
The cuss am I? Are you cussing with me?
No, you cussing with me?
Don't cuss and point.
You're gonna cuss with someone. You're not gonna cuss with me, you little cuss.
Me.
You.
Just by the tree.
That was Bill Murray as Badger and George Clooney as Mr. Fox in 2009's Fantastic Mr. Fox, written by Wes Anderson and Noah Baumbach, based on the book by Roald Dahl, and directed, of course, by Anderson. Back on episode number 510, we played Adam's conversation with writer-director Alex Ross Perry and the star of his new film, Listen Up, Philip, Jason Schwartzman. Schwartzman, of course, we were thinking of as a frequent Wes Anderson collaborator. That was our tie-in, but Rose Messer from Naperville had a few more for us.
Rose says, Mr. Fox has a few narcissistic tendencies, although he's the charming kind of narcissist. And Christofferson, Jason Schwartzman's rival and cousin in the movie, is even more of a narcissist. Bill Murray is in that scene, and he has played a number of great movie narcissists, from Steve Zissou to Peter Venkman to Phil Connors. And George Clooney, the other actor in the scene, played Everett from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, whose Dapper Dan obsession signals at least a certain amount of vanity, if not the other trappings of narcissism. That was our top five theme on that show. Additionally, Noah Baumbach shares a screenwriting credit on Fantastic Mr. Fox, and you name-checked him in mentioning the squid and the whale on
there
that
you
show.
Go.
We did indeed. And we got some other comments about our performance, Josh. We said it was a first in the history of the show where we actually had to do those animal sound effects.
Snarling and hissing.
We said completely unrehearsed. We didn't say we didn't discuss it first, but we didn't rehearse it. We just wanted to let the magic unfold in the moment. Andy Timko, right here in Chicago, Lincoln Park, says, I refuse to believe that that was your first take.
That was the kids' reaction, too.
Really?
I wanted to play that one to them, see how long it would take until they knew the movie.
Honestly, it was like eating at the Rainforest Cafe.
We aim to please.
Well, Mark from Shanghai has an even higher compliment than that from Michael.
It was indeed awesome. Mark says, you totally nailed that. I had to re-listen just because it was so much fun. It is one thing to be on pitch in movie karaoke, but what really makes these fun is when you guys have fun. Sublime,
I disagree,
is
by
when
the way.
Is a beautiful coalescence of the two. After a few rewinds and re-listens, I stopped the podcast and went in front of my television and watched Fantastic Mr. Fox. The ending with the wolf still stirs something within me. Also, I might be wrong in the narcissism diagnosis, as how can I call him a narcissist when the title of the movie clearly states how fantastic he rightfully
is? This is a good
point.
I like
that.
This is a good point.
I mean, such a title makes his hubris seem almost in check. P.S. I got giddy like a school child when I realized the music from the scene just following that take is what you used for the music for the first commercial break for so many years now. Sigh, it's the little things indeed.
That is true. So the longtime Massacre Theater theme has always come from the Royal Tenenbaums. Mm-hmm. And so then Sam, when he decided to add some music to that first sponsor break, he thought we had to keep it in the Anderson family and did pull it from Fantastic Mr. Fox. And now more listeners are cued into that.
I should say that I have a book coming out in the spring. And it's called Narcissism, What It Means to Me.
Can't wait.
I would read that. I would read that, Michael. If you want to hear our top five movie narcissists and that interview with Alex Ross Perry and Jason Schwartzman, you can get it by subscribing to the podcast on iTunes or listen at filmspotting.net. Josh, I wouldn't say super brimming, but pretty good turnout. Pretty good turnout.
Pretty good brimming.
Yeah. So reach into the hat, pick out this week's winner.
The winner is Mark Crilly from Novi, Michigan.
You know, it's Novi. I'm pretty sure
it's
Novi,
of course it
Michigan,
is.
Just like Lodi, as Creedence used to sing. Congratulations, Mark. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we will set you up with your very own Film Spotting t-shirt.
Dracula requires presence. It's all in the eyes and the bones and the head.
That's right. That's right. You seem a little agitated. You want to go outside and get some air?
I'm ready now. Roll the camera.
Well, I don't know if we'll be able to apply any adjectives like sublime to this week's Massacre Theater, but we will try to have a little bit of fun.
There should be no snarling or hissing. Let's get that straight from the beginning.
We would really be adding an interpretation to the scene if that were the case, but it is a three-person scene. I don't think we need to give you any hints or descriptions of how it ties in with this week's theme. We're just going to dive into it. I started off. Michael, Josh, are you guys ready?
Yes.
Here we go.
Let's go.
Josh, you're going to give me the action.
And action.
The stores aren't nice to people. I don't like it.
Stores are never nice to people. They're nice to credit cards. Okay, stop fidgeting. Get rid of your gum. I don't believe you did that. Yes?
I am Mr. Hollister, the manager. May I help you?
Theodore Lewiston.
Ah, yes, sir.
You see this young lady over here?
Yes.
Do you have anything in this shop as beautiful as she is?
Oh, yes. Oh, no, 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 no. I'm saying we have many things as beautiful as she would want them to be. That's the point I was getting at, and I think we can all agree with that. That's why you came in.
Excuse me. We're going to need a few more people helping us. I'll tell you why. We're going to be spending an obscene amount of money in here, so we're going to need a lot more help sucking up to us.
And
scene. There was actually spitting, no hissing or snarling, but
that's
there
right.
Was
but
spitting,
I did
so.
Nevertheless have to do a sound effect. I don't know if it was quite as good as the one 2 weeks ago. And yes, we did modify the name there a little bit to not make it any more obvious than the scene may be. If you know what scene we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, November 10th.
Winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on the show in a couple of weeks. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
We fill it around for a while with other travelers of the night, playing hogs of the road. Then we headed west. What we were after now was the old surprise visit. That was a real kick, and good for laughs and lashings of the old ultra-violent.
Josh and I just had some fun playing Hogs of the Road on Lower Wacker on our way over to the studio tonight, Michael. So that clip was a perfect transition.
Wow. I'm good driving times. On the way home, by the way.
That was Malcolm McDowell's Alex, of course, from A Clockwork Orange, which helps us get into this week's top five, inspired by Halloween, movie costumes that we'd actually wear. And when we announced this top five last week, we asked listeners to send us pictures of themselves in their movie-inspired get-ups. You could post it on Twitter, send it to us via email or on our Facebook page. And we got many over at the Film Spotting Facebook page. We heard from Vanessa Vinci, who sent along a picture of herself dressed up as Alex, along with another showing off her very impressive Ash from Army of Darkness costume. Yes, complete with chainsaw hand. She also sent this note explaining her costume choices.
I love dressing up, and these are two of my favorite of the cosplays I've done. Ash from The Evil Dead, Army of Darkness version, and Alex from A Clockwork Orange. The most important thing about dressing as a character is finding one with an outfit or look iconic enough to be worthy of the effort. Being able to move around easily and see is also a plus.
Okay, so we're going to get into that criteria, the criteria that Vanessa had here in a moment, but we do want to recognize Candace and the Film Spotting Advisory Board for this top five suggestion. It was FAB member and longtime listener M. Robert Turnage who gets the credit for this one, or does he get the blame, Josh? Do we know yet whether or not he deserves blame?
I was a little reluctant, but it was fun. And actually, after expressing my initial reluctance, my next thought was, oh, but we're going to get some great listener photos.
Yeah.
And we did.
We did. Facebook.com/filmspotting. That's where you will see the brunt of them.
So let me ask you this, guys. As adults, as any time over the age of 18, what did you actually dress up as?
Josh just did this, so he can tell you.
Well, yes. I was, depending on who you talk to, I was either Peter Pan or the Hulk
or Robin Hood.
Or Robin Hood.
Wow. And I couldn't tell.
It was a daughter's birthday party.
It was green.
I think it was initially meant to be Robin Hood.
That's what I was thinking. But
so the kids were coming all dressed up. I threw it on last minute, and yeah,
I just happened to have it.
But the kids were happy. One of them came up to me. They're like, "You're the Hulk," and he was thrilled. And I'm like, "I am the Hulk."
Well, wow. We did misfire with this one a little bit in that this show is coming out Halloween weekend. We could have done it a week ago or 2 weeks ago, and actually given our listeners some fodder for costumes.
True.
If they were so inclined. Now they're going to miss out on all these gems that we're about to unleash
pearls,
on them.
Pearls.
But Vanessa, she talked about an outfit or look iconic enough to be worthy of the effort. So it has to be something that people get. Hmm. People recognize it. It's iconic. And being able to move around easily and see is also a plus. So very practical as well on Vanessa's side. I'm curious if either of you guys, and Michael, we'll start with you, if you had such a criteria, was practicality, was iconography an issue for you at all?
No, I mean, I didn't favor the superhero thing. I'm not. It's not my favorite holiday. I dress up more for Arbor Day. Also Guy Fawkes Day. But I didn't think practically at all. And I guess everything I have on my list requires footnotes and an asterisk to explain what the hell it is.
Wonderful.
So it's great for radio.
Yeah, it is. Let's jump right in then.
My number five is Ming the Merciless from the old Flash Gordon
serials.
Love this. Yes.
See, ruler, this is going to be great because as soon as each one goes up, I'm just looking at you guys and picturing you in them.
Ruler of the planet Mongo. First of all, planet Mongo. I mean, you know, that's aside from the Blazing Saddles reference, which was, you know, eerily prescient decades ahead of time. Charles Middleton was the actor who played Ming back when. And the hallmark, of course, was this collar that was, you know, halfway to kind of a cone of shame, you know, like a really big but sort of flame-shaped, delightful and, imposing. You could really disrupt any party with it. But nobody would really know what you because nobody remembers it. So it's really more of a history lesson for people. That's my number five.
I like it. Not Max von Sydow from the Flash Gordon
from the 80s? Early 80s? No.
Okay.
No.
Well,
no, I wouldn't want a good actor representing, you know, just Charles Middleton, Ming the Merciless. I wouldn't actually go Ming the Merciless. I'd probably go Ming the Merciful. I'd probably try to turn it around a little bit.
You'd be nice and give out candy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that makes sense on Halloween.
Nice touch.
Josh.
So, yeah, I've dressed up for Halloween as an adult. My sister for years had a party, and first I'll get out of the way a few of the characters I did think about because I had been them, but that just seemed too easy. I wanted to put a little more effort into it. But years ago we would go when the kids were, you know, infants and you have to bring them with, so you incorporate them. So one year we were the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I dressed up as a big wardrobe. Adeline was a little lion. Debbie was a witch. It worked. There was a contest. I think
How
we might have won.
Be a wardrobe.
Oh, that a big box, and you just cut doors open. It was a little hard for doing karaoke that night. Then another year, we were Rosemary's Baby. This one I really liked.
That's
so
good.
I was the devil, Debbie was Rosemary, and Beatrix was the spawn of Satan, I guess.
Nice.
I don't know. We haven't.
I knew there was something.
We haven't told
about
her
you guys
about that yet. So, wow. And then we all already covered my recent Robin Hood debacle. So, set those aside. And for my number five, I thought I wanted to have. I know you're going merciful, Michael, but I want to have at least one scary character,
sure.
Somebody who is frightening. Now, I'm not really all that into the gore costumes or the Halloween gore decorations, so I wasn't going to go the zombie route. But apparently I am into death by peculiar weapons because my number five is Anton Chigurh and his cattle gun from No Country for Old
Stun
Men.
Stun gun?
I mean, nice. Sometimes, as can be seen from my Robin Hood thing, you just need an easy costume, something you can throw together quick. And all you need here, really, I think, is the
world's
jeans
the world's worst jacket.
The page boy, I probably have to find a wig for that. Yeah. I don't know if my hair could pull that off. The oxygen tank, I think, would work. Get yourself an oxygen tank. And that would be the cattle gun. And then, of course, the kicker, I would just have to walk around with a coin to flip, you know, to really make people uncomfortable. The real challenge for this costume would probably be pulling the dead eyes that Javier Bardem gives this character. I mean, normally I'm not that soulless, but...
No, I usually only see that during my setups.
Exactly. Start, start to glaze over
and the murderous glaze. Yeah.
I bet I could mimic it also, though, you know... If you're a bit of an introvert, you get put in a room full of people at a Halloween party who you don't really know. That's kind of my default expression, so that wouldn't be too difficult.
I like it. Well, for me, I did initially, and I have at least one of these on my list, maybe a couple. I thought about an offshoot of a list Sam and I did here on the show 400 episodes ago, which was if I could be. Basically, the coolest characters.
Sure.
If I could be these characters. And so Halloween and dressing up in a costume kind of gives you that
chance. It's aspirational.
To be aspirational. Exactly right. So that's something I thought about. I also, in doing some searches and seeing other movie-inspired costumes out there, I started to feel kind of bad that none of my picks were as clever as a few of the ones I saw, including one, not from a listener, that was Jack Torrance from The Shining, right? So... the long hair that Nicholson has, the red bathrobe that he's wearing, the axe, of course, but the topper is his head through a door, walking around with a door over his head all night long. Just here's Johnny perfection, right?
That'd be good.
And then one that did come from a Film Spotting listener over on our Facebook page, Billy Ray Bruton, went as Daniel LaRusso as the shower in The Karate Kid. There's a Halloween party in The Karate Kid where LaRusso, kind of like your wardrobe, he... wears a shower.
Yeah.
So I thought that was pretty inspired as well. And I did put one on my list that I tried to get onto that level. We'll see if I succeeded. My other idea was simply to put a piece of tape over my mouth and be silent the whole night. And when people asked, I could later tell them I was God in a Bergman film.
No.
Okay.
You can't rely on that much audience participation for your costume.
That's why I left it off the list.
Good.
But just like you, Josh, for my number five, I had to have at least one that was legitimately scary. So let's see if you guys can guess the movie and the character from this description, because this is a costume you can actually buy. You can go on the internets and order this if you want. Experiencing a troublesome end-of-the-world vision? Seek the meaning and significance on Halloween in this officially licensed adult costume. You'll have no trouble in this menacing bunny costume.
Oh, Donnie Darko.
Yeah, Donnie Darko, the character Frank.
That's right,
the
Frank.
The costume you can order is a gray, white, and black plush coverall with attached paw gloves and a matching character hood mask with mesh see-through eyes. Nice. Now, here's the scariest part of this costume. It costs $140.
Wow.
I may, if I decide to go this route at some point in the future, have to ask my mom to sew me one by hand, like when she made me and my sister Melissa go as pumpkins.
Aww.
Not that I'm still traumatized by that Halloween or anything.
There's Adam. But... let's smash him.
Basically, though, I could don that costume and just walk around counting down until the end of the world and trying to get everyone I see to do really bad things.
28 days. 6 hours, 42 minutes, 12 seconds. That is when the world will end.
The bunny thing would be cool because if you had the money to pay like $300 for the giant boiling cauldron, you could do a Fatal Attraction thing.
You could go that route, too. And then a lot of famous bunnies.
It's a double act. Yeah.
But I like it because Vanessa talked about being iconic. I think that movie, kind of a cult movie, but still instantly recognizable and legitimately creepy as hell.
Oh, yeah.
Frank from Donnie Darko.
That would be terrifying if someone walked in that thing.
My number five, Michael, what is your number four?
I, too, went on the actual web. The web. Is we call it the web.
Okay, good to know.
Although I think the Tribune up until like last month was still calling them weblogs instead of blogs.
Instead of blogs.
It's like, oh, yes, a Chicago Tribune weblog. But you go to PartyCity.com, as I do every day anyway, and the worst, laziest, stupidest costume they had is one called the Adult Cozy Captain America costume. It's not even a real costume. It's just a zip-up hoodie that has a little bit of the Stars and Stripes on it. And, I mean, if you were in a ring with a Mexican wrestler, you'd be the most easily vanquished adversary he ever – awful, you know. So I just like the sheer laziness of that costume.
There's no shield.
No, there's a shield.
Okay.
There is a shield.
Okay.
But even just to call it the adult cozy Captain America,
yeah, a little
to me, that's my number four. I'd have one completely lazy, cynical pick. Very comfortable.
I like it.
It takes you 5 seconds to put it on.
You are a patriot, Michael.
Thank you.
My number four is a Maleficent, Angelina Jolie.
Really?
As Maleficent. Oh, yeah. I mean, every Halloween
that's
has...
Say, hey, it's kind of like the Emperor Ming.
They're a little... Yeah, we could be a
team.
Pair.
Yeah,
we could.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. We'll have to do that. There is a hot, trendy costume every year, and one of them is Angelina Jolie's character from this year's reimagining of the Sleeping Beauty fairy tale. My 9-year-old, she's jumping on the trend. She got the store-bought version. It's pretty cool. I figured, why not join her? It looks pretty good.
Wow.
This does still remain. Maleficent was one of my favorite films of the year still, and the costuming played a big part in this. I mean, Jolie... She looks great early on when Maleficent is still a good fairy. She's got the flowing green dress and the expansive wings, but things get spectacular when she goes bad and her costume turns black. I was reading up on the costume a little bit, and the designer, or at least the lead designer for the team, is Anna B. Shepherd. She's an Oscar nominee for The Pianist and Schindler's List. She was interviewed by The Hollywood Reporter, and I liked how she described the overall look they came up with. Savage elegance. And apparently they used animal skin covered horns, jewelry made of real teeth and bones, and these head wraps she wears, they're done in like ostrich, stingray, and fish skins. And all of that detail, it really does come through in this film. I mean, there's a plethora of CGI in this thing that's kind of a weakness, but otherwise it's a real tactile experience. So I know what you're thinking, Adam. I can see it on your face. I don't have the cheekbones.
No.
For this, it's true. But you know what? Even Jolie,
neither did she. Yeah.
She got help from makeup master Rick Baker. So I could cheat.
We could maybe afford him for one night.
Could we?
Yeah, maybe.
Special radio discount for Rick Baker.
Seriously, yeah. I would pay good money to see you in that getup.
That's the one you're going to want to see, huh?
So my number four is one of those that's a little bit aspirational, even though you could rightfully describe this character as a loser. And you guys did so well with the first one. We'll see if you can guess this one as well. I'll tell you that it's from the 80s. Total nostalgia pick here.
Roadhouse.
It is not Dalton, but God, that's a good pick.
Police Academy 6, Mission to Moscow.
Steve Guttenberg from the original Police Academy, another one right in my nostalgia wheelhouse, but you guys are 0-2. I'll give you the outfit. For this character, the outfit, the getup, it's all practical things you can go out and buy right now, but it's all about layering. Long sleeve white shirt, red plaid flannel shirt, jean jacket, twill long coat, gray jeans, leather boots, black shades, half-finger driving gloves, burgundy scarf, and I would also have to get my ears pierced so I could wear the studs. Any guesses?
Breaking Away.
It's a movie set in Chicagoland, not Indiana like Breaking Away. I am speaking of one John Bender.
So, are you guys like boyfriend, girlfriend? Steady dates? Lovers? Come on, sporto. Level with me. Do you slip her the hot beef injection?
Go to hell!
Enough! Hey, what's going on in there?
Judd Nelson. The Breakfast Club.
Sure. Yeah.
Those layers. I mean, apparently it was freezing there in the Chicago suburbs that he had to wear the jean jacket and the plaid and the coat over the top of it. But as I said, total nostalgia pick. I was in fifth grade when that movie came out. Might have been, I was thinking about this, it might have been my first exposure to a screen anti-hero in a way. I mean, I was only 10 years old. He was the star of that movie, though, the coolest character by far, the funniest character, the instigator of all the action that happens in that movie. And every line that we quoted, me and my friends quoted from that movie from fifth grade through eighth grade, was a John Bender line. So trying to hearken back to the glory of Judd Nelson. That's the costume I'd wear.
He was really prepared for any sort of weather, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Thinking back on it, huh?
Yep.
I did go one year just as Judd Nelson's nostrils. That's two giant sort of black holes.
Yeah. I could see that.
I think I told you about the time we were almost hit by Judd Nelson. Haven't I shared that on the show?
No.
Yeah, when we lived in L.A. It was close call.
Wow.
Really?
He was wearing a lot of layers in the car, too. I don't know why.
And sunglasses, and he couldn't see.
Wow.
That must have been it.
Wow.
We'll take a quick break here, then we're going to finish our list of the top five movie costumes we'd wear for Halloween. Fair warning, guys, one of mine may involve a Speedo.
Oh, please, no.
Stay with us.
Whenever Paul thinks of rain, swallows fall in a wave and tap on his windows with the beaks. And when Paul thinks of snow, soft winds blow round his head, and the phone rings just once late in night, like a bird calling out.
Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit is a bi-weekly podcast hosted by BuzzFeed's Allison Wilmore and Matt Singer of The Dissolve, focusing on the world of online movies.
More information at filmspottingsvu.com or subscribe to the show on iTunes.
Hi there, Film Spotting Original Recipe listeners. This is Allison Wilmore from the Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit podcast. And on our new episode, Matt Singer and I wonder if murder really is all that solid a basis for a friendship as we discuss Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer.
And in honor of Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, and in honor of Halloween, we'll recommend some other indie horror movies, all available to rent or stream at home right now. To listen to the podcast, you can subscribe in iTunes or check us out at filmspottingsvu.com.
Hey, I'm Ellen Page.
And I'm Diablo Cody.
We are the actor and writer of the film Juno, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Welcome back to Film Spotting and this special Halloween edition of the show. We are sharing the top five movie costumes that we might actually wear for Halloween, and we want to start by quickly recapping our five and four picks. Michael, you had...
from the 30s Flash Gordon serials, Ming the Merciless, ruler of the planet Mongo, as played by Charles Middleton. And my number four was the adult cozy Captain America costume you can get on PartyCity.com. It's a zip-up hoodie. That's it. It's just a zip-up hoodie.
Is Party City paying you for this?
Nothing, but I did I mention
free,
it was...
free hoodies?
It's PartyCity.com. By the way,
we'll link to it in the show notes.
Fabulous.
Great. My number five was Anton Chigurh, Javier Bardem in No Country for Old Men. And my number four was Maleficent, Angelina Jolie's Maleficent.
My number five, Frank the Bunny, the not so bunny rabbit from Donnie Darko. And number four, John Bender from The Breakfast Club. For our radio listeners here on WBEZ, if you want to hear our takes on those picks, you can find the full version of the show, which regularly runs. When Michael's here, we get a little bit long-winded between the three of us.
And yet I never talk. You guys are just yakking.
I know. That is
it's
one of the
Inyari-2
drawbacks
version of Film Spotting.
That's it. You're right. It runs closer to 2 hours usually. So if you just can't get enough, go to filmspotting.net or find the show over at iTunes. Michael, we are at your number three. Is this another one we can find on Party City?
It's my final PartyCity.com.
Oh my goodness.
Selection. It's the 1960s Batman costume. That's complete with batwing gloves, gray jumpsuit, and yellow utility belt. Now, I picked this because the funny thing is I had all these things separately for years, but this outfit pulls them all together. It's $129.99. It reminds me of Adam West. Of course, this was a show I watched with my brother back in 66, I think 67. It's really only good for the Neil Hefti musical theme, which I still love. But that outfit, if you're going to wear a Batman costume, I don't really go for the really dark, inky black. You know, it's got to look a little dorky, mm-hmm. the way it did.
There's a little more room to breathe in that one from what I remember.
Yeah, and it's just more congenial for whoever drops by, Julie Newmar or Frank Gorshin or any of those. So that's my number four.
I like it.
That was my sick day show, actually. For whatever reason, when I was homesick from school, little Price is Right, and then a couple of Batman.
One of the reruns, yeah.
Oh, yeah, for sure. All right, my number three, of course I was going to be a Wes Anderson character, and it was really tough picking one because I love Mr. Fox's suits. I'd like to put one of those on. And I recently started playing tennis, so I could have gone Richie Tenenbaum and then used the headband afterwards, you know, rather than toss it out like you do with Halloween costumes. But I went with Bill Murray's Steve Zissou from The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. And I do want to be clear here, though I tried to scare you with the tease. I'm going with the powder blue shirt and pants ensemble,
okay.
the red cap and the Adidas.
That's better mental image.
I'm not going with the Zissou Speedo, though I think I might still have the promotional Speedo that they sent out.
Really?
It might be in a closet somewhere, unless I burnt it. I don't want to see. We've talked before about the reoccurrence of uniforms in Anderson's films, and his characters are often people who desperately want to belong to a community, and creating some kind of standard uniform that people have to wear is one way they force that community onto others. So of all the Anderson uniforms, the Rushmore Academy letter jackets, the khaki scouts, shirts and scarves, Team Zissou's powder blues, those are my favorite.
Okay, I knew you were going to go Anderson. It was just a matter of
you
which
character. You
approve
of that choice?
You know, I'm
You're not
still,
really that invested.
I'm still one of the only people involved with this show or listening to this show that doesn't adore that movie. So
missing
I
out.
Need to get on board with that. My number three is from a recent film, a Coen Brothers movie, Llewyn Davis from Inside Llewyn Davis.
Ooh.
Two things you need to truly pull off this character I'll never have. A fantastic singing voice that Oscar Isaac has, the actor, and genuine talent. Actually, three things. I'll never have a great beard. I'll never have a Michael Phillips-esque beard. I would have to do some work, get Rick Baker to help me out with that one. But I can go buy a fake beard, and I can buy that curly-haired wig. I can buy a caramel corduroy jacket and a scarf. And, of course, I'll have my guitar in tow. If I have to get it out and play it, I can. After all, as John Goodman's character in the movie informs us, folk music is just three chords. It's not like jazz where you play all 12 notes on the scale. And one hand the guitar, the other hand the orange tabby cat.
That's going to be a problem.
All night long. It's going to make it hard to also carry around a sack for candy or a drink at a Halloween
that's
party.
That's good, though. I like that.
Most importantly, I'm allergic to cats, Adam. We can't go together.
I can't bring it here in the studio. But, of course, if I was worried about how I'd function at a party, I'd be Llewyn Davis. I'd be too good for any party that would actually have me, and none of the good parties would want someone so bitter and cynical to ruin their night.
Right, yeah, okay. I can tell this is one of those things where I keep saying no and you think I'm just asking you to beg more.
Yeah, that's right.
Right, well, look, I'm not a trained poodle.
I thought singing was a joyous expression of the soul.
Yeah. All right. This one's early. Joe should like it.
You'd get thrown out.
I would get thrown out. So, you know what? I'd just be on my own wandering the streets with my guitar and cat, and I would have become Llewyn Davis.
Nice.
My number three. Michael, you're number two.
That's such a melancholy pick.
I know. I'm a melancholy guy.
Yeah, no, that's good. My number three is strictly for the overcoat. It's Robert Donat as Richard Hannay, the hero of Alfred Hitchcock's 1935 film, The 39 Steps. I truly, sometime around the age of 10 or 11, I saw my first Hitchcock films. The Birds was on television when I was in fourth grade. I think Psycho right around the same time. And then eventually more and more on television. And one of those around that time was The 39 Steps. And I remember just thinking, it was my first sartorial observation as a kid. I love that tweed overcoat. I love the way that collar goes up. You know, of course, I'm just wearing is like stupid hand-me-down baseball jackets for my brother and all that. And this was my first, you know, moment of pure style aspiration. I would love to wear, and you know, all through high school and college and well into my 20s, all I wore were knockoff, you know, crummy Minnesota versions of that same overcoat from Ragstock and other stores. You know, anything I could get that would last 1 year for $10. It was always because of the 39 Steps.
Really?
So that's my number two.
Yeah,
maybe,
that's good.
Maybe for the holidays. Someone was listening.
It's a
You'll
good
get
look.
That coat.
It's a good look.
You'll
but
get that coat.
The problem is it's a costume with footnotes and an asterisk, and nobody wants to talk about the costume.
You'd have to do a lot of
explaining. Hey, who are you?
And no, then that can be part of the fun, too. That can be part of the fun of wearing an obscure costume like that.
Yeah, for about 5 minutes. It'd be fun, yeah.
Well, I think my number two would be pretty obvious to everyone. And Michael, it's going to be familiar to you because you recently had to sit through me waxing on about this character and this costume in particular. It's the Creature from the Black Lagoon.
When we did animals.
Top five movie Manimals. That was in connection with our Tusk review. Adam, still waiting to hear about your top five movie Mandibles. I don't know why you haven't got on that and made that a priority.
And I still haven't made it through that episode. It was just the profundity. It was so deep.
Things got pretty thick. You've got to take that in installments. I agree. Good idea. As I mentioned there, though, this costume, it's a thing of beauty. The webbed claws, those frilled scales, that fin down the back. It's a seamless creation compared to so many movie monsters. And one of the key figures on the creature design team, who I failed to mention on the show we did, was Millicent Patrick, an actress who also designed monsters in the likes of This Island Earth and The Mole People. And I found on the sci-fi site Tor.com this long article about her in 2011. It recounted some of the squabbling that went on about whether she should get the credit or the makeup department head George Hamilton Westmore should get the credit. They sent her out on the publicity tour to kind of promote this beauty who created the beast, I think they called it. Whoever was most responsible, though, they created something that was disturbingly human and prehistoric at the same time. The creepiest scene, I think, in the film is when the creature is captured on the boat and they have him in that holding tank. So he's below deck a little bit, covered with these bamboo slats, just looking up from underwater at whoever's walking
around. I'm getting scared just listening to you.
So, you know, for full effect, I don't know how I do this, but I'd want to be wheeled into the party in a tank of water, you know, just staring up at people. I don't know if I could pull that off, though.
No, I don't know. Great pick. My number two, we talk about coolest characters in cinema. Characters
Robert Donat in the 39 Steps. We established
even
this.
Even better than Robert Donat. I'm going to go out on a limb.
He could kick John Bender's ass.
He could,
sorry,
but he could not take my number two, The Man with No Name from the Dollars trilogy. And of course, I could just say I want to be Clint Eastwood in any Western, but specifically A Fistful of Dollars for a few dollars more and The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And this costume, I don't know if it's available on Party City or not, but it does exist.
Michael?
I'll look it up.
It does exist. You can go order it online. The site I found describes it as the Clint Eastwood wandering gunman adult costume. This gunslinger and bounty hunter was more of an anti-hero with a distinct moral ambiguity.
Wow,
so they're editorializing.
There's some film criticism going on.
This authentic
Party City.
Western.
.com doesn't do that.
No.
I got nothing but blank stares last time I went into Party City. You got anything in your moral ambiguity aisle?
This authentic Western wandering gunman adult costume includes a brown poncho with white Mexican designs, rugged brown vest with attached light blue faux shirt. Attend your next costume party as the mysterious man with no name from everyone's favorite spaghetti Western cowboy movie. So here's the fine print, though. Here's the asterisk with this one, Michael. Here's all you get when you buy this costume. You get the poncho and you get the vest with the shirt front. You don't get, not included, the hat, the holster, the gun, the pants, the spurs, the shoes, the scarf. You know what else you don't get? The best squint in all of cinema.
The squint.
And that attitude that you own every single room that you walk into. You also don't get the cigarillo, right?
Yeah, right. You
Which
need that.
You get to chomp
the cheroot.
On.
Yeah.
You get to chomp on that and either just be really quiet and really still and look like the total badass that you are, or you get to talk through those clenched teeth and look even more badass.
I don't think it's nice you laughing. You see, my mule don't like people laughing. It's the crazy idea you're laughing at him. Now, if you apologize, like I know you're going to, I might convince him that you really didn't mean it.
So,
how much is that?
I want to be the man with no name.
With all that stuff missing?
You know what? I didn't order it. I was too disappointed. So
better not be over $19.99.
Number one, your number one movie costume that you would wear, actually, for next Halloween, Michael.
My number one is actually the worst mustache in cinema. It's Marcello Mastroianni in the comedy from 1961 called Divorce Italian Style.
Good
and
movie.
I'm picking up on your swarthy. Your man with no name, swarthy. Uh-huh. But this is, I mean, I love Mastroianni in this film. It's the first film I saw him, that made me realize what a great screen comic he was, sort of on the level of Cary Grant in terms of like the smoothest, coolest, most dashing guy, but with the greatest comic instincts. The whole slick back hair look, the striped pajamas. This is assuming it's a pajama party, you know, a Halloween. He's playing an impoverished Sicilian nobleman in this film, who's got the morals of a snake, and he's got it's just a great look. And even if you have to explain it to people, the mustache, which is this big, hulking, downward-turning thing that just Takes all the sort of dash out of Mastroianni. I love the look.
Yeah.
You know, and now I'm probably just going to cultivate it in an everyday way as I enter further into my 50s.
Now, you could do that. You could get rid of the beard, Michael.
The beard would go. I'd have to kind of...
You're halfway there?
I'm halfway there.
Love it.
All right, my number one, Indiana Jones. And I had a feeling that Indiana...
Michael, here
to rub it in a little bit
All right, you know what? We agree on the hat.
Okay, good.
All right.
And, you know, it wasn't going to be my number one until I heard you were going to be on this show. And then I figured I had to put it on. Now, I knew it would be simply because of my love for the character. But then it turns out what I learned over the past week or so is that I needed to be Indiana Jones again to correct a childhood error, apparently.
Really?
I was Indiana Jones sometime in the mid... No, probably early 80s. I bet it was between Raiders and Temple of Doom. So I would have been thinking nine, something like that. I remember thinking it was the most awesome costume ever at the time and that I was just a dead ringer for my then movie hero. Turns out, not so much.
Is this the one you posted on Facebook?
This is.
Because, yeah, I had no idea who you were supposed to be.
Heartbroken. I found an old photo of me and my sisters going out for Halloween where I'm supposedly dressed up as Indiana Jones. Let's just say it's a bit of a hodgepodge conception of the character. The hat is the wrong color to start with. I'm wearing a plaid
cowboy shirt.
And the face paint.
The long hope for a Western sequel.
Right.
Yes. Yes. The face paint. I think it's supposed to be stubble, but for some reason it goes all the way up over onto my forehead.
And why were you wearing like an oven mitt?
Well, his gloves. His gloves. Those were clearly like my dad's work gloves or something. So yeah, I put this up on the Larson on Film Facebook page saying this is going to be my likely number one character. Nobody knew who it was.
I think there was one listener who
picked it up. Now that I'm a parent, I have a pretty good idea of what was going on. You know, when you get to that point and you're just like, you look great. You know, like you don't want to go buy something.
It's been going on for too long.
This is like three hours. It's like, that's perfect. You look great, even though it's nothing like it. Maybe that is what happened to me. So it worked on me then, but not now. So I'm going to be Indiana Jones again to redeem myself.
Well, I certainly considered Indiana Jones as well, and I like the redemption angle there, Josh. All right, my number one. Three reasons why this is my number one pick. I wanted one that wasn't on the nose. Maybe you did have to tell the story. People are not going to look at you and know right away who you are. I wanted a female costume. Not that I was struggling to come up with a good female character or a good female outfit or struggling with the idea of wearing it, but could I pull it off? Mm. Could I really do it justice?
Did you have the figure for it?
Did I have the figure? I mean, I know you're going to nail Maleficent, but, you know, I didn't know that I could do that. Number three, the third reason is I wanted something from a movie this year. Something that tapped into the zeitgeist, right? Because that's what Halloween costumes every year, they respond to what's big right now. So what's big right now? I wasn't wrong. I Googled it, and sure enough, there are a whole host of Ebola costumes.
Sure. I've heard this. I've seen
that
this.
That you can get. Yeah.
Emergency Ebola nurse.
Including, you know, it's gone legit mainstream when you can get the sexy Ebola nurse costume.
Oh, come on.
Which is out there. So with that set up, those reasons are why I want to be the, quote, cool girl from Gone Girl. The great thing about this female character is that I don't really have to pull it off because, as Gillian Flynn tells us, she's mythic. She only exists in the minds of idiot men. And Flynn, in the book, though, and in the movie, does give us a pretty good description to follow if you were going to wear such a costume. I figure I'd need a wig. I'd wear a football jersey. I'd tell lots of dirty jokes. I'd only drink and carry around cheap beer all night long, while also carrying around a plate of hot dogs and hamburgers. I'd burp a lot, and I would need to be a size 2, but I've already got that down. So no problem there with the outfit.
Pre-Halloween diet.
No, I think I can pull all of that off. I would be the mythic cool girl.
Well, and you know, if that's not going over well, you could still stay in theme. Just splatter yourself with ketchup, strip down to your underwear, and then you're Rosamund Pike.
There you go. I can go either way with this character.
I like it.
If I choose. But that's my number one. Tapping into the Gone Girl sentiment that's out there right now.
Jumping on the bandwagon.
I am.
Very good.
All right. Those are our top five movie costumes that we would wear. Any others that you guys want to throw out? Honorable mentions. Ones that you considered.
What else is available at Party City, Michael?
I don't know. I realized 2 out of 5 was probably enough for Party City. But my honorable mention would be Franklin Pangborn in anything because of the way he wore those pince-nez. You know, I would love to master that You know,
bring those back.
Wearing the pinchers.
I'm looking at you like Josh looks at me during our setup. So
Pangborn, you know? No, you don't know Pangborn?
No.
He's the guy, he's in the Preston Sturges ensemble. Okay. He's the guy who says, "Death, where is thy sting?" You know, he's a very, very kind of outre camp character. Wonderful character, man. He was also in International House with W.C. Fields, you know, a lot of early. He was in Astaire Rogers films. He was always playing these officious bank clerks and hotel managers and just a great character. But typically in tails, you know, long coat and the pinchers. And it's the pinchers I really
Do know who you're talking about
someday,
now.
Someday.
But a lot of those films you mentioned I haven't seen. That's our next film spotting marathon.
What, just stuff I just said? Stuff I just said is your next marathon?
Michael just uttered. What about you, Josh?
Well, I thought maybe I could pull the Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe box back out and repaint it and be Hal from 2001.
See, I really kept thinking about that, but I could not come up with like how that would actually work.
You'd have
the
to like, put a big red dot on it and then scrunch inside for the whole party and just kind of sit there. But,
I like it.
I don't know.
I like it. Well, I have two other females I considered. The Bride, Uma Thurman in Kill Bill. Sheriff Marge Gunderson from Fargo.
Oh, yeah.
One of my aspirational ones really would love to be Snake Plissken from Escape from New York. Not so aspirational. Dr. Strangelove might be kind of fun to play.
Murph and Muckle, it would be great to play the president, you know, with the bald, paint. And the...
Any of those characters, really, that Peter Sellers plays would be great. I also thought about one of my favorite films, Network, and Howard Beale. I'd get to wear my pajamas in a raincoat, and I'd just walk around with wet, disheveled hair saying, "I must make my witness." That's a good one.
Yeah, yeah.
And finally, we mentioned Frank from Donnie Darko was my number five. When I came up with that one, and I was thinking about movies from this year, I also thought, well, I'd like to be Frank from the movie Frank. I could
with
pretend
the big head.
To be Michael Fassbender, which, that's aspirational. And then I'd be wearing the paper mache head, and that would be fun. I'd carry around a microphone. So then I thought, I could just make my whole top five out of movie Franks. Frank Booth from Blue Velvet, Frank T.J. Mackey from Magnolia, and Dr. Frank Enferter.
Nice.
So,
that's
honorable
mention. That's a lot of wig changing you'd be doing all
night. That's true. But those are, again, our top five movie costumes that we'd wear. I think we have to give credit to M. Robert Turnage and the FAB. That was a lot of fun. We hope you enjoyed it. Please send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
This week's new film offerings are as skimpy as the sexy Ebola nurse costume. Apparently, Hollywood assumes that we all have better things to do than spend the weekend at the movies. Here in Chicago at the Music Box, you can see Harmontown, the doc about community creator Dan Harmon. Horns is out. This is a film in which Daniel Radcliffe might be the devil. That's all I know about it. Also out in wide release, Before I Go to Sleep, the new thriller starring Nicole Kidman and Colin Firth, and Nightcrawler, Jake Gyllenhaal seduced by the morally dubious world of freelance crime journalism. Rene Russo in this movie. It's been a while since we've seen Rene Russo on screen.
Well, come in. In fact, the film is from the writer-director Dan Gilroy, who I believe is her husband in real life.
No kidding.
Yes.
Good little tidbit there, Michael. You don't have to give away your review, but have you seen Nightcrawler
already? I like Nightcrawler.
So see it if you can.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's good. And Horns,
No, not so much.
I don't care if it's a seasonal thing. It'd be great to pick a devil movie this week.
Yeah.
Know, but no.
See House of the Devil, Ty West. That's a good movie.
There you go, yeah.
Is Daniel Radcliffe the devil? Can you answer that?
I will not discuss that.
Okay. Yeah. Fine. Next week on the show, we will discuss Nightcrawler with Jake Gyllenhaal and Rene Russo. And we're going to share our top five nocturnal movies. So movies that are set predominantly at night.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board, especially for that great top five this week. Special thanks also to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Michael, thanks as always for stopping by. Sorry for the Raiders references
and the Marx Brothers disdain
that you have to put up with.
It's a big world full of all kinds of stupid opinions. It's fine.
Aside from the Horns review, Nightcrawler review will probably be up there. What else are you writing about at chicagotribune.com/movies?
Some older films, among other things this week, Rome, Open City at the Siskel, and Hiroshima Mono More at the Music Box.
Rossellini and Renee, good stuff.
Yeah, so some old, some new.
Music this week is from Andrew Bird. From his 2014 album, Things Are Really Great Here, sort of. More information on that is at andrewbird.net.
Birdman, Andrew Bird. Sometimes we are very obvious here on Film Spotting.
For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
But first, our review of Birdman, an ambitious comedy drama that takes jabs at costume superheroes, egotistical actors, and elitist critics. Time to find out how well the three of us can take a punch.
You want to do egotistical again?
Costume superheroes, egotistical actors.
Oh, okay, that's the way you say it.
How do you say it?
I say it more like egotistical.
Egotistical.
Did you hear the difference there, Let's hear Michael.
It's the difference between Iowa and Illinois. That's all. I'm hearing.
Substantial differences. All right. Go with it.
Kind of defines the show, I think.
Yes, it does. All right. Birdman.